Well, first of all, I'd like to ask for your patience because I I'm getting out of a pneumonia that has been visiting me for 2 weeks.
And, Brother, could you talk up?
Well, that's one of the reasons. I was going to say, if you feel like you're not going to get to hear me, just get closer because I can't raise my voice. Mm-hmm. So that's something that, you know, I hope you, if you can't hear me, just get closer because I'm not going to be able to raise my voice too much. So that's something. And the second thing is that this is all about, it's not only about Augustine, but I thought that it would be great to connect these two guys that we have, you know, here and there. Especially because we have inherited this monastic spirituality, and I think Augustine and Saint Benedict have a lot to say today to us, to the world, and to Benedictine Augustinians and, you know, religious communities. So that's something that I really like to go over with you. Of course, to begin with, a brief introduction to the life of Augustine. So you can try to picture this guy, because I'm going to center my kind of conference or talk, if you want to say, on the rule of Augustine. But first of all, I want to talk about him, because there might be some of you who are not very familiar with the guy. First of all, I have to say that this is a fascinating guy. And he was born in Tagaste in North Africa. And this is November 3, in the year 54. He was part of a Roman colony. This is part of a Roman colony in Numidia. Today is this area is part of an Islamic nation, Algeria. And his father was a pagan, Patrick, was his name, where you can find that. A non-believer, of Roman origin, he was baptized shortly before his death. And as you probably know, his mother was Monica, was dedicated Christian, and Monica was of a local Berber stock Egyptian appearance. He had a brother and a sister. Augustine grew up in a mixed atmosphere, we will say, of faith and unfaith. So he was not baptized when he was a kid, as you can imagine. At school, he showed intelligence. He was very smart from the very beginning, in his very early age. At home, he spoke a Punic dialect, and he was introduced to Latin, and he decided that he wanted to become a public speaker. So while he was a teenager, he kind of messed up, and you'll probably find that when he read a little bit about Augustine. But at the age of 17, he fell in love with a woman. He lived with her for a while, and they had a son. His name was Adeodatus, which means given by God. But Augustine was not at peace with himself, so he felt kind of restless. There was something going on that there was a lack of something in his heart, and he couldn't find it. It's probably called truth. What is it? He didn't know. He didn't know how to call it. But this is something he was looking for in his life. So this is very important. Monica worried about her son. She prayed continually for Augustine's conversion. She wanted him to find peace with God, of course. She came across Africa to seek him out and try to separate him from his partner. This woman happened to be the mother of his son. Welcome. But he found it difficult to change, so he kept putting off putting it off. He kept saying, and I learned that Deacon John was saying this yesterday, and this is a very famous phrase of Augustine, make me chaste, but not yet. Okay. I'll leave it there. One day in September, this is the year of 386, he finally made the decision. He was sitting in the garden with his friend, Alypius. He heard a child's sing-song voice saying, over and over, take and read, take and read. Tolle legge is it's a famous phrase in Latin. So he, what was it? So he read Romans 13:13 in the New Testament. And, you know, this is the beginning of the conversion of Augustine, of the probably seven conversions that Augustinians talk about. But we're not going to talk about this today. But this is something that really changed his life. And, of course, he started this Christian journey. Augustine began his preparation for baptism. And so Easter time in Milan, in the year of 387, and I remember talking about this for a while, this is very, this is something that really changed his life, of course. He gave up his university lecturing in Milan when he was baptized when he was 33. He decided to move back to North Africa, and, you know, you'll find this if you read about Augustine. He wanted to live a quiet life of his study and religious reading. Yeah. Augustine wanted to stay there for the rest of his life. But people knew his brilliance, and he was a very talented man. So, and this is what, if you have the program here, we're going to talk about the iconography of Augustine. I have to say something about that. 5 years later, he was pressed. And to be, I have to say that first he was kind of pressed to become a priest. He didn't want to be a priest. He just wanted to pursue, you know, this life. You know, he wanted to study and live with other friends, and, you know, devote his life to prayer and the study of, and all that. So this is not part of his plan. Of course, this is part of God's plan. But not, it wasn't in his mind. So, and after that, poor guy was present to become a bishop. This happened in the year 396, and he was the town of Hippo. That's what we call Bishop of Hippo. Today, near Algeria's border with Tunisia, as a bishop, he preached. And soon became very famous. He was a brilliant guy. So he became very famous around there. Many of his sermons were written, and were very glad that he didn't have a computer back then, because he used to talk a lot. Even though he used to actually kind of complain about, you know, his voice and all that. He probably had problem with his vocal cords and stuff like that. He used to talk like this all the time. So this is something that he complained a lot in his sermons. You will find that. And actually, we're going to go over one of the sermons where he said, you're standing there, I'm sitting here preaching, sitting here, so I'll be sure. And then like five, six pages after, he said, well, I was going to be sure, but, you know. So this is not a new thing, as you know. So his most famous book is the Confessions, of course, and I have this book right here if you want to take a look at it whenever we have the break later on. And he wrote about 113 books. That's why I'm very glad he didn't have a computer, because the poor guy will be reading all the time. So. And still today, one of his famous books, of course, is the Confessions, but we're going to go over the Rule. The Rule is a very, very simple book. It's called the Libellum. You can call it like that. But, you know, this is a little book that he wrote. Well, we're going to talk about that later. As a bishop, he's still living in the community, and this is what surprises many people. You know, he wanted to live in communities. Augustine is big on community life. He needs people around him. He needs to eat with his brothers. He needs to pray with his brother. He needs to live with them. So, first of all, he started this monastic way of life in a monastery with some of his friends, who later, actually some of them became bishops of other cities and all that. But, you know, this is the very beginning. When he became bishop, he had to, you know, other obligations and stuff like that. So he moved to another monastery very close to the monastery where the monks were, the brothers. And then he wanted to live with some of the priests around them. And there were, of course, there was a rule. They had to follow that rule. Everything was in common. There's nothing you can call yours. Everything has to be in common. And we're going to talk about this because he had a big issue with that. And it's going to be interesting. You're going to like that part. So after 30 years as a bishop, he appointed a successor, and he died when he was very, very old. For that time, to be 70 or something like that, you know, you were very, very old, very old. So he still continued writing at the age of 76. He died on August 28th. There is a discussion about that sometimes. The year of 430. And this is very nice that he actually asked to write some of the psalms on the wall while he was in bed, so he could recite the psalms while he was dying on his journey to the Father. This is very interesting. So Augustine is a great philosopher, great theologian, and a great community life and monastic life. So I think there's a lot to learn about this interesting and fascinating guy. So the second thing will be, if you have the program there, Augustine in the iconography is desired to be a monk rather than a priest, a bishop, a judge, or anything like that. He didn't want that. And this is something you will see around. The Augustinian iconography, it's full of pictures of Augustine like this, as a bishop. But the thing is, the reality is that he really wanted people to see him as a monk, a person who lives in community and all that. And actually, people were, Augustine very closely, try to emphasize on this, because he really wanted this. He really wanted this life of prayer and all that. Of course, you know, things get in their way, on his way, and stuff like that, and he can't do it like the way he wanted. But, of course, he gave it a try. And he wrote the rule for his monks, and were his friends by that time. And this is like when we start talking about the rule, this is a religious rule that developed by St. Augustine, written which came to use in the 12th century, and continues to be employed today is by a large number of orders and congregations, including the Dominicans, which is an order that's very well known to many of us. So we can say that there is the origins of the rule. We can find the origins of the rule. The title, especially the rule of St. Augustine, is being applied to some of the following documents. I would like to share this with you because I had I actually made copies of this, so you can have it. It's the one for itch.
Excuse me.
So this is something that that's probably going to help. I'll provide the rule of Augustine later on, but this is, I don't want you to get distracted with that. So many papers. Thank you, Mrs. Elias. Thanks a lot. Well, this is the letter 211 addressed to a community of women, and this is very interesting. Sermon 355 and 356. And I actually said this when I gave this presentation to the novitiate upstairs. I said, you know, you can't die without reading these two sermons. This is very, you really need to read this before you die. You know, this is something you gotta do. These two sermons are very interesting because they talked about the love of monks should be. And you shouldn't be calling anything, you know, but everything should be in common. So this is something that's very interesting. The third will be a portion of a rule drawn up for clerks of Consortia Monachorum. And of course, we can find a rule known as Rule Regula Secunda, and another rule called the Vita Ermitica. But we're gonna center our talk is and this very interesting letter 211, which is addressed to a community of nuns. And you could say, well, how is it that the monks are following this? If it was written for the nuns, well, everything is cited because his sister was a prioress, we'll call it, of the community. His sister was the president of a religious community, and they had to change, you know, they resigned, they had to change, they were going to have another superior, they had another superior already, and there were some problems, as you can imagine. We're human beings, and we have this kind of little problems in communities, and I actually remember when I was, I said this to Brother Simon. I have a very good friend of mine. She's a sister, and she remembers. This is just an example of, you know, a community life can be kind of complicated sometimes. They have a little elephant, the TV of the community. You know, that was there for years. And, you know, she, all of a sudden, they changed the TV and all that, because, you know, it was getting old. And they changed the TV, and she got the little elephant and put in another little table around there. You know, it was in the living room. Oh, the sisters got so mad. They didn't talk to her for, like, weeks. So this is something.
Put an elephant there.
So the elephant became very famous in the community because, you know, it's been there for like 20 years and all that, and all of a sudden you take it up. So this is something, I'm not surprised this happened in a community of nuns back then, and they had so many problems there, and he writes to the nuns and say, you know, listen, this is not why we came here. You know, this is not the center, and I'm going to give you the rule of Augustine later, and you'll see what the whole thing is about, you know. This is very interesting. The main purpose of us being here in the monastery is not to be complaining about a little elephant. Well, the elephant is it's a case, but, you know, it's an example. So, written in the year of 423, to the nuns of Hippo in a monastery that had been governed by his sister, in which his cousin Nice lived. So his object in writing it was merely to quiet troubles and send it to nomination of a new superior. he took occasion to go over some of the virtues and practices essential to religious life as it was understood by him. I think, you know, the rule of Augustine is very clear on, you know, little... Well, he doesn't go over little details. So I think there is something that really we should take a look at. It's the reason why everybody says, you know, this was written by Augustine. There's no thought about that, I think, but for now. It's because he has been proved. You can find that in other works of Augustine, like the Work of Monks, which is a great book. Strongly suggests the same hand and for the rule which bears Augustine's name, and the manuscript tradition can, you know, they can prove that. There's a very good harmony, a great harmony between what he thinks and what he writes. And of course, he's not making this up. He just talk about the gospel. But this is how we're going to live here in a monastery. The approximate year of the composition is year 397. Sometimes people say around there, that time. And recent research has demonstrated that the third component of the rule, Augustine's rule, this letter 211, and sections 5 to 16, which you're going to see there, can no longer be regarded as a stricter unity. So you're not going to find this as a, this isn't written, the whole thing together. So they put things together as a rule of Augustine later on, and we'll see when. So the context and the influence, I will say some, I'm just going to point this out to you. The rule, Swin talks about the sharing of possessions, chastity and obedience to your superior, anticipating, of course, by many centuries, the traditional vows of consecrated life of poverty, chastity and obedience. Noteworthy, excuse me, it's this provision for a library, and you will find this a very interesting point in the rule, the daily distribution of books, which indicates that he was very interested in the the formation of his monks, especially about the biblical part. Of course, St. Jerome, by that time, will say, you know, ignorance of scriptures is ignorance of Christ. So this is very important to him. Some eight chapters let me say this first. So he's actually talking about freedom, forgiveness, and prayer. And the final chapter possesses this touch of spiritual beauty as a contemplative dimension of common life. Some eight chapters of uneven length are very good in this 35 biblical citations from the Old and in the New Testament. So this is something I just want you to know. The immediate impact of the rule upon, you know, the Southern Europe was as being described by many authors by this as this Augustinian invasion. So at least a dozen of references to Augustine's rule are found in Benedict. And the rule of monks rebuild and dependence upon Augustine's rule, which subsequently constituted a powerful force in shaping both the canon regulars and the mendicant movement of the Middle Ages. And I have to say that some today, some 150 communities of women and men profess the role of Augustine. So this today is still, this is still alive. So this was not, this didn't happen until you know, the long time after the author's dead, and the expansion of this. When we talk about the Gregorian reform, the 11th century, and their connection with the with this reform of the church, they wanted to, really wanted the priests to live together and do something about it, because they were just living by themselves, and there were a lot of problems going on. Around the middle of the century, priests in the cathedrals began gathering as houses of canons, living a communal life, observing a monastic horarium, eating meals together, and sleeping in a common dormitory. From this time until the middle of the 12th century, many hundreds of new communities of canons appear in west of Europe. But, you know, especially the Gregorian Reform was not happy about this. They wanted something more. So that's why they put the role of Augustine as a guideline for these small communities. And because it was, they found this perfectly suited the needs of the age. And by the end of the 13th century, thousands of religious communities and several religious institutes have embraced the rule of Augustine as their guide for an organized religious life. Certainly, one of the reasons why the rule was adopted by some in religious communities was because of its flexibility and generality. If you go to St. Augustine, St. Augustine's rule, and you compare it to other rules, let's say, and that's why I wanted you to bring a copy of Benedict's rule, because we're going to talk about this. When he talks about prayer, he says, you know, there's two lines about prayer. That's it. And then you go to Benedict and it goes like chapters and chapters and chapters, and this is the psalmody, and this is the office of, you know, night, and this is how we should do it, and this is the psalms that we're going to... So, if you're founding a community, if you're, you know, beginning a community, any of you, you probably choose Augustine's rule. Because it was, you know, very general and all. So this is something that it's really, you can find this in the books, and I'm not making this up. So formed by a number of North Italian congregations of hermits, the Augustinian Friars is one of the several religious organizations, the Carmelites are another congregation, order too, which originated as a hermetical contemplative order that found itself powerless to resist the appeal of the mendicant ideal. So they changed their lives. So at the very beginning, they were very, this is a whole monastic setting and stuff like that. So, but, you know, after that, very soon they moved to the cities. Like the Franciscans and Dominicans, the Augustinians quickly moved to the cities where they undertook, apostolates and, you know, schools and these universities and parishes. And this wasn't the plan of Augustine, of course, but he also says, you know, wherever the church needs you, you should go. So it is hard to resist the conclusion that the rule of Augustine was the most adaptable of all the ancient monastic rules. So that's that. And I want to go over this rule of Augustine with you. And of course, if you go to the rule of Augustine, which is 73 chapters, and you go to Augustine's Rule, has 8 chapters. There's kind of a difference. So if there's a volunteer who could get these out.
Brother, maybe you're going to do this at some point, but there is a question I'll make quickly, not right now, but Augustine, I understood at that point, ultimately there were abbeys at that point, weren't there?
Well, he never calls it an abbey.
Okay, just mentioning that over in Paoli, Pennsylvania, there's a monastery, I think, are the Norbertines of some kind of a branch of the Augustinians?
They follow the Rule of Augustine.
Yeah, and they themselves operate as canons. They say that's different than monks, anyway, whatever that means.
Mm-hmm.
And they are, just like the Benedictines, independent houses. Then the Augustinians originally were not independent houses. They were always combined, so people could transfer from place to place.
Yes, I met the canons in... I met the canons in Spain, and this is very interesting. They have independent houses and stuff like that. They don't. It's very curious thing.
The secession never were then. They were always a unified order.
Well, yeah, they're still an unified order. The thing is that they're not part of the order. They're not considered as part of the Augustinian. The Augustinian order right now, it's just the OSAs. OAR, the Recollect, and the Discalc Augustinians. The rest, they're just not part of the order. They're associates. They're associated themselves.
I have a historical question. Excuse me. You talked about at the time of the Gregorian Reform and its effect on the Augustinians. Where were the Benedictines in relation to the Augustinians? Were they running side by side? Was there any contact? Because the Rule of Benedictines were existing for a long time. So where were they in relation to the Augustinians early on in the Middle Ages?
Maybe Father Augustine can answer that question better than me.
Because
I don't...
Well, don't forget, the Augustinians, I mean, talk about the Augustinian order early on.
But why?
The Benedictines, the people following the Benedictines.
But there was no contact between them.
They're not going to know what I'm reading about that.
At the time, say, the Gregorian thing. If Pope Gregory was giving orders to the Augustinians, I'm just thinking, well, where are the Benedictines in relation to all that? But there's no contact.
Well, the next point, thank you very much. The next point here will be to talk about, we're going to go over this rule, as you can see, it's very short. I'm not going to go over the whole thing, of course, but I want you to get a sense of what it looks like. And this is what I call the fascinating points. What's the rule about? And what's so different, you know? First of all, I have to say that this first line and a half was not part of the rule. This came after, and it's still kind of an issue for the Augustinians especially, because who put that there? Oh, very nice. Yeah, who put that first line and a half? Well, we can say that Augustine could say that, because you can find this all the time in his works, but who put that there? Well, if you know the answer, please let me know. Well, so that's why number one, it starts, you know, in the second line. The following are the precepts, and this is what they call the receptum, what we're here in the monastery, and this has to do a lot with the nuns. Yeah? We're not here to, you know, because we have a new superior, and we're going to try to make their life miserable. So this is not what we came here to the monastery. So this is the main purpose, and I think this is something that we should highlight always in our lives. The main purpose what we came here the main purpose what we are trying to live this monastic life, even out there when we're oblates or we're working and doing whatever, the main purpose we I want to get closer to God. It's because He's the one. Yeah, He is the one. And there's something, and if you stop by later, you'll see the Augustinian cross here, which is cor unum in Deum. Augustine, this is a motto of Augustine, one heart towards God. And he wants that for his community, upon God in oneness of mind and heart. Call nothing your own. This is number three. And he's going to have an issue, a big issue with that, and I said that before. This, and because in his monasteries already, there were people already who, you know, thought they were so important because they entered religious life. They had nothing before they entered, but when they entered, they would consider themselves, you know, important people. Now I can't have what I didn't have in the world. So this is something he makes clear in the first thing. Those who own something in the world should be careful in wanting to share it in common once they have entered a monastery. But they who own nothing should not look to those things in the monastery as they're enabled to have in the world. Monasteries will come to serve as a useful purpose for the rich and not the poor. You could say, if the rich are made humble here and the poor are puffed up with pride. So he doesn't want that in the monastery. They should seek the glory of the fellowship of poor brothers rather than in the reputation of rich relatives. And this is another issue they have. Because, you know, rich parents giving their sons to the monastery, and then, you know, you get some privilege. Well, we don't do that here in the monastery. We didn't do that here in an Augustinian monastery. So this is something he wants to make clear, a point that... And what's at the end of all of this? And I will say at the end of all of this, what he wants is the ordo amoris, which is something that's always present in his works. The ordo amoris is the order, the peace of all things is what he calls. And this is in the city of God. He wants peace in the monastery. He wants to establish his peace in the monastery, place of peace. So what's peace for him? What's the order in love? This is the peace of all things. This is what he wants. And in number eight, he calls again, live together in oneness of mind and heart, mutually honoring God and yourselves, whose temples you have become. And this is, I think this is the mystical interpretation of the community. Temples of the living God. This is what Augustine says. We're temples of the living God. And if you think of it, if you come to think of it, it's if he wants one heart, one mind, it's all of us coming from different places, different cultures, different families, thinking and feeling as a community. Mind and heart, thinking and feeling as a community. When you get that, you get a real community. When you get to that point. And look at chapter 2. This is funny. Be assiduous in prayer at the hours and times appointed. And then he talks about how you should, you know, do things in the oratory, and you shouldn't be around if a brother, you shouldn't be playing the guitar if a brother wants to pray. So that's something that he really emphasizes. And I think the most important part of that chapter is number three, And this is something we can apply to ourselves. When we pray to God in psalms and hymns, think over in your heart the words that come out of your lips. This is very important. And I think we tend to, probably tend to forget this, you know. We tend to read. It's not about reading. When you go from reading to prayer, it becomes a real pleasure to do that. It was a problem back then that some people in the community want to sing and chant everything. So, to avoid that, people were so in love with music, chant only what is prescribed for change. Moreover, let nothing be chanted unless it is so prescribed. Just don't leave that there. Chapter 3 is moderation and self-denial. And we're going to talk about the refectory, an Augustinian refectory. It's very special, because when you come to a table, you should listen. And this is not something new. We've heard about that in Benedict's rule. You should listen until you leave what is accustomed to read. Why is it that we have to do this? And he explains that in the second line. Let not your mouths alone take nourishment, but let your hearts too hunger for the word of God. So it's not only about eating. And this is something that probably I've heard people who come to the monastery and other communities that I've been, and they say, you guys eat differently. You didn't just eat. We eat a lot. But this, you guys do something different. I don't know how to call it, but you guys do something different. Well, praise be God, if we can, you know, if we can try to make that happen, you know, it's not only about eating. It's all different culture. You know, when we eat, we're not just feeding ourselves. We want to be filled by the word of God too, by words of wisdom. And that's why we read while we have dinner and this and that. So this is very special. And you can find this refectory for Augustine is very important. And you can find this in when Posidius talks about the refectory of Augustine. He says that the plates were made out of clay, but the utensils were made out of gold and silver, to remind the community that you could be poor, but you don't have to be miserable. So this is something very interesting. Another very thing that I found very, very interesting is that he put a sign at the end of the refectory that will say, and I remember reading this in Latin, and we learned this when I was in first year of philosophy. Quisquis amat dicit absentum rotere vitam, ac mensam et digna nobody is a CB, which means that if you like to talk about the person who's not there, the absent brother, you're not worthy to be sitting at this table. So they had a problem once because some of the brothers were talking about an absent brother, and he stopped the whole community and he said, you know, either we stop talking about this brother, or we should take that down. So this shocked the community. It's been a custom in Augustinian communities to put that sign in the refectories, but they stopped putting it because, you know, I think sometimes it can bother me. I don't know. If you put it there, I feel kind of obligated not to talk about the absent brother. So if you put it there, it can bother some people. So that's something. That's the refectory of a...
Look up to Father. Look
that's
up
right.
to Father.
No, that's all right. Let him keep going.
So if thus a more delicate help health for their former way of life are treated differently in that matter of good, you know, because you, of course, you, if you're sick, you're not going to be, you know, eating the same thing that the community is eating. And I've experienced this in the past 2 weeks. You know, well, this doesn't mean other people should want this, because then you're going to get the brothers, he gets cheese because so I'm going to be sick tomorrow. I guess so. I want to be sick tomorrow. So, okay, get cheese. So that's part of it. So he gets something different. Why? So that's something he tries to... So he's trying to avoid this, you know. Trying to convince their monks that this is not the way of acting. Nor should all want to receive what they see given in larger measure to the few. That is talking on honor. This is number 4. But as a help to support them in their weakness. This will give him give rise to the public disorder that in the monastery where the rich are coming to bear as much hardship as they can, the poor are turning to more genteel way of life. But this is something that really happened probably in the community. For it is better to suffer a little want than to have too much. And you're going to find the chapter 4, it's a very, very large chapter. Why is that? Because Augustine has a big issue with chastity. And he wants to make this point clear that this is a place where we should try, at least. You know? Yeah. This is a place where, you know, he already, when he was younger, he tried to live together with some friends and he fell, because he said, you can't have your wife here and your family here and stuff like that. And your wife and the mother of your wife, which can be a problem sometimes, or this or that, that fell when he was younger. So he already knew if you're here, the church and the needs of the church should be enough for you. You don't need anything else. And I think the center of this chapter is number 3 in chapter 4. In your walk, poor man, in all your actions, let nothing hurt to give offense to anyone who sees you, but only what becomes your holy state of life. And if can somebody read number 4, please, for me?
Right. Although your eyes may chance to rest upon some woman or other, you must not fix your gaze upon any woman. Seeing women when you go out is not forbidden, but it is sinful to desire them or to wish them to desire you. For it is not by tough or passionate feeling alone, but by one's gaze also, that lustful desires mutually arise. And do not say that your hearts are pure if there is a modesty of the eye, because the unchaste eye carries the message of an impure heart.
Stop right there. This is something. Especially that last, the unchaste eye carries the message of an impure heart. And don't say you're so holy if you're not. You know? This is something that this is part of correction, fraternal correction. And you'll find this in the role of Augustine. Fraternal correction is very important. And taking care of each other, it's important in the rule. So this is something that really to keep in mind.
Can we think about the fact that because he lived with a woman for, 12, 13 years,
yes,
had a son, he was very focused on this. This is not as great a focus in Benedict, is it?
Mm-hmm. No.
To this extent. So yep. He had a lot of personal experience, mm-hmm. and I think he knew the difference between lust and love.
Mm.
And I think he was really, probably, as he read in City of God, even, struggling with it for the mm-hmm. rest of his life.
Yeah, when I started my, at the beginning of the presentation, I talked about a little bit about, I didn't say too much about it, but I gave a little bit of some details about, you know, how this can influence the whole, and we're going to talk about this at the end, too. So we'll go over this again. Thank you, Mr. Weiss. If you're, and I want you to go over, you know, this is number 8, and page 4. If, by the end of the paragraph, number 8, if your brother, for example, were suffering a bodily wound that he wanted to hide for fear of undergoing treatment, what? Would it not be cruel of you to remain silent and at mercy of your part that makes this to make this known? How much greater then is your obligation to make this condition known, lest he continues to suffer mortal of a deadly wound of his soul? And this is something that comes after the procedure when he talked about. He's not making this up. This isn't in the New Testament. This is in the Gospels. The procedure is that you talk to, if a guy has been receiving letters from a woman, or, you know, has been, I don't know, talk to the person, go to the spirit, let him talk to him privately, and if he doesn't correct himself, you know, talk to him in public. Get some other brothers to know it. And if he doesn't correct himself, treat him as a non-community member, even if he stays. So this is kind of, you know, this is the whole procedure that he, and then, you know, so it is important for a brother to, you know, talk about this whenever you see that your brother is suffering or is having issues with that. So again, this is because Augustine had issues with it. So he wants to avoid it, his brothers. Number 11, but if anyone should go, you know, well, I would like to say that this is something that we're going to find in the rule of Benedict too. Show mercy and pray for him if he confesses this in his own core. But if the offense is detected and he is found guilty, he must be more severely chastened according to the judgment of the priest of superior. That's the end of that chapter. A good lesson, I think, is in number 1 of chapter 5, where each of your, you know, of you gets back, because there were some issues with people who, you know, I wore this. Of course, they didn't wear habits like how they wear today. I wore this, you know, last month. So you said, why are you giving me this back again? So I don't want to wear the same thing. You know, you should give this to another brother. You don't do it. Give it back to me. You know, this kind of things. And then he says, if this is the kind of issues you have in the monastery, you may judge from this how lucky you are in that holy and inner garment of the heart that you when you quarrel over garments for the body. So if you have issues with that, this is number 1. By the end of the paragraph, you may judge from this that you're not as holy as you think you are. Yeah? This is a lesson for us, I think. So whenever you show greater concern for the common good than for your own, you may know that you're growing in charity. So I think the most, you know, the highest point of Augustine's rule in his works is the virtue of charity is there, but you get there just when you find yourself more concerned about the community and the common things rather than your own things. So that's when you get to that high point. Yeah. Accepting gifts, it was a problem. So this is something that really, and I wanted to go over with you that about, because when he talks about in the sermon 355, he talks about the many problems he had, cases like Januarius, one of the priests, Boniface's legacy. These are people who join the monastery and they make their will, and they have some families and all that. And he said, and one of the policies to enter his community was, you can't have anything. So how come you come now and then your family appears before me and they say, we have a will? Huh? Well, before this time came, himself drew near to death, and he's talking about this guy, and swearing consistently that it was his own, not his daughter's, he made a will about it. A priest, a companion of ours, is staying together with us, living on the church, professing the common life, made, I am telling you, a will. He made a will. He said he will be his heirs. Who will be his heirs? Oh, what a sad blow of a company of ours. What fruit not produced by the tree which the Lord has planted? He made the church his heir. I don't want these gifts, says Augustine. I don't like the taste of such bitter fruit. I myself had recruited him for God. He made profession of our company. This is what he will keep to. This is what he will serve. He will have nothing. He shouldn't make a will. He has something. He shouldn't pretend to be our companion as one of the God's poor. So this is a big issue. See, he's in the middle of all this and he says, I don't want this gift. I don't want the legacy of this man. He was supposed to get, part of the fortune, and he said, I don't want it. Because this is not something that we should be doing. So this is one of the problems, one of the issues he had in so many. The case of Luporius, a priest who donated everything, and people who say, he didn't donate anything. He sold everything. Well, I was witness of that, and so he does that in the middle of a sermon. He talks about it. So, and people are concerned about the reputation of a bishop. He's a bishop. I know, he says, you see how much my reputation means to you. As for me, my conscience is enough.
I think you have the last word, my conscience is...
is enough. So that's enough for him. So the treasures of a community are the old and sick members of the community, for Rule of Augustine, the people who run the pantry, the clothing part of the monastery, the books, should serve their brothers, and a very good example of this of Augustine being strict and flexible at the same time is in page 6. Number 10 and 11, when he says, Ms. Elias, can you read that? Number 10? Number 10? Yes, can you read that?
Books are to be requested. Is that the section 5?
Yes.
Am I in the right place?
Yes.
At a fixed hour each day, and anyone coming outside that hour is not to receive them. And then 11, right away?
And then right away after that, he says,
but as for clothing and shoes, those in charge shall not delay the giving of them whenever they are required by those in need of them.
So that's Augustine being flexible and strict at the same time. Mm-hmm. There are several things that are not. You negotiate with that. Mm-hmm. But there are other things that you should be flexible about. Asking for pardon and forgiving of offenses is another thing that it's last part of the rule. Yeah, and when he says, but a brother who is never willing to ask pardon or does not do so from his heart has no reason to be in the monastery, even if he's not expelled. So he's not placed in the monastery. And then and I want to go over this, and then we have a break. Chapter 7, page 7. This is something that we're going to talk about that later. When we talk about authority in the monastery and the superiors of the monastery, a superior should be obeyed as a father. Well, but he must refer whatever exceeds the limits of the power of his office to the priest who enjoys greater authority among you. Augustine says that the superior of the monastery is a primum inter pares, which is a Latin phrase for that, the primum inter pares, which is the first among equals. And when you go to Benedict, he goes like, you know, because the abbot is to hold the place of Christ in the monastery. What? Well, this is a different vision, but we're going to talk about this later. There's a common thing that we can find in both of them. He should strive to be loved by you rather than fear. And it's very interesting, but Augustine and Benedict say, both of them, they say that in fear before God, he should be at the least among you. So he is going to give an account about all of us, the superior of the monastery. So both of them agree in that. All right. And finally, chapter 8, this is what people call the mirror of the rule, because he compares the rule with a mirror. Look at yourself and say, you know, this is, am I trying to live this, you know, way of life with the remembering the rule, keeping the rule in my mind, and trying to follow it, or not? So for that reason, he wants the community to read it frequently, so you can remember that. And when one of you finds that you have failed at any point, let him be sorry for the past, be in his guard for the future, praying that he will be forgiven his fault and not be led into temptation. So this is something that's really interesting. We're gonna stop now and have a little coffee or donut, whatever we have left.